Welcome back. Today we are diving deep into an artist, someone whose name is just instantly recognizable, Edgar Degas, synonymous with Parisian modernity, really. But his life story, it demands a much more complicated look, doesn't it?
It really does. Degas is fascinating because, well, everyone groups him with the Impressionists, right?
Yeah.
But he spent his whole career pushing back against that. He hated the label, called himself a realist, sometimes independent. He was kind of the anti-Monet in a way.
Yeah.
Famously disliked painting outdoors on plein air. For him, the studio, that was where the real art, the perfection, happened.
A real revolutionary in technique, though. I mean, his mastery of line, composition, it's just undeniable. Yet the sources you've shared with us, they paint this picture of a personal life and personal beliefs that seem totally at odds with that brilliance. It's a really stark contrast.
Exactly. And that's our mission today, to kind of unpack that complexity for you. The sources highlight two major areas of debate, really big ones, surrounding his legacy. First, how he depicted women, his female subjects. And second, the documented evidence of his personal prejudices, racism, anti-Semitism. It forces you into this difficult question. How do you judge the art when the artist himself seems, you know, so deeply problematic?
Okay, let's unpack this paradox then. Starting where Degas spent so much of his focus, the women of modern Paris. He did something like 1,500 works just focused on dancers alone. That's incredible. So what stands out first about how he portrayed women?
Well, I think what's immediately striking is his commitment to the unidealized figure. He wasn't painting goddesses. He was intensely focused on their physicality, the rhythm of their work, their bodies in motion or at rest. But this intense observation, it kind of opens the door for two completely opposite ways of reading his work.
Right, like critics were looking at the same paintings but seeing totally different intentions. So what's the argument for empathy, for realism?
Well, many critics argue, quite convincingly, that he gave a certain dignity to working women.
Yeah.
Especially those in really tough, low-wage jobs. Think about his paintings of laundresses or ironers, like women ironing. He captures the specialized skill, sure, but also the sheer difficulty, the exhaustion of that labor. These are poor women, and he often silhouettes them, their tired forms, against these quite luminous backdrops. He wasn't making it pretty. He was treating their work as a serious subject, worthy of high art, you know.
And the ballerinas, too, right? It feels like he deliberately sidesteps the stage glamour most of the time. He seems more interested in the grind behind it all.
Absolutely. Almost always backstage or in rehearsal.
Yeah.
You look at ballet rehearsal or the dance class, he's capturing those candid moments, unguarded. The stretching, the aches, the yawning, the sheer exhaustion. He stripped away that stage romance to show you the physical effort, the relentless training involved.
Okay, but if he was so focused on the hard labor, the reality of these women's lives, how does that fit with the other side? The argument that he was, well, cold, maybe voyeuristic, even misogynistic.
That reading tends to focus more on his nudes. Because there, he completely broke from tradition. No more idealized Venus figures. Instead, he shows women doing very ordinary, unglamorous things like bathing. The tub is a famous example. And what really made these controversial was his perspective. He often used this very odd high viewpoint, like you're looking down from above,
yeah.
Sometimes called the blown-off roof perspective. It makes the viewer feel like a spy almost, intrusive.
That distance. It does feel like a deliberate choice, maybe removing the viewer from feeling any responsibility for looking.
It definitely creates ambiguity, and that ambiguity is perhaps most unsettling in that famous painting, Interior. Some people even call it the rape. It's incredibly dramatic, theatrically lit, just one lamp. You got the man standing there blocking the closed door. The woman's hunched over on the bed looking utterly defeated. Critics have argued about it for ages, with the marital problems, or something darker like the aftermath of sexual violence, maybe prostitution. It echoes themes in Zola's novels. The feeling of menace is just palpable. But he never tells you the story. He holds back.
Right. And this brings us to something really fascinating and controversial. The Little Dancer, age 14. This was the only sculpture he ever showed in public during his lifetime, wasn't it? And it just ignited this whole debate.
It absolutely did. I mean, the realism alone was revolutionary for the time. It was this mixed media wax figure dressed in a real fabric tutu, a real tulle skirt, and wearing a wig made of actual human hair. And the model, Marie Van Gotham, she came from extreme poverty. Her mother was a laundress. Her sister was actually documented as a prostitute. But the critics, they didn't really focus on the artistic innovation. Instead, they kind of projected all their own societal anxieties, their prejudices, onto this young girl.
So instead of seeing her vulnerability, her situation, they saw vice, depravity.
Appalling language was used. They called her face a rat's snout. Described her as a flower of precocious depravity. They even used the term petites, rats, little rats, which was slang for the young dancers in the opera corps. It implied pretty strongly that for girls from her background, dancing was often seen as just, well, a pathway to prostitution or exploitation by wealthy male patrons. And that vulnerability, that hint of exploitation, it connects right back to some of the paintings, doesn't it? Like The Star, where you see that shadowy male figure lurking backstage. It hints at that reality.
Okay, so the art itself seems to provoke these really divergent readings, empathy versus objectification. But when we turn to the man himself, the documented facts about his beliefs... Well, that seems a lot less open to interpretation, unfortunately. Let's shift now to the documented evidence of Degas' personal prejudices. These cast a really dark shadow, don't they?
They do. The sources are quite clear about his deep and troubling connections to racial prejudice and the institution of slavery. This stems largely from his mother's family, who were Creole and based in New Orleans. They were wealthy, and their wealth was tied directly to the cotton trade, which, of course, relied entirely on enslaved labor. There's even documentation showing that part of his mother's dowry came from the sale of an enslaved person.
And Degas actually visited New Orleans himself, didn't he? In 1872, stayed for about 5 months. That trip led to the Cotton Office, which was a big early success for him.
It was. The painting is celebrated, but his letters from that period, they are profoundly disturbing to read now. He wrote about the city's black world, using just explicitly racist, dehumanizing language. He described the black population as an immense black animal force.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't just him. His relatives there were active in the local white supremacist movements, including the White League. So these aren't just, you know, historical details. This is documented evidence of a man deeply embedded in a system of racial hierarchy and seemingly sharing its views.
And it wasn't just race, was it? His anti-Semitism became quite pronounced later in life, affecting his friendships.
Yes, that really came to the forefront during the Dreyfus Affair. That started around 1894. It was this huge political scandal in France. A Jewish army captain, Alfred Dreyfus, falsely accused of treason, it completely divided French society. Degas became vehemently anti-Dreyfusard, and he broke off friendships with Jewish friends, people he'd known for years, like the critic Daniel Halevi, purely because of this political and social divide. He was apparently quite brutal about it.
It sounds like he cultivated a kind of isolation throughout his life, really.
He seems to have been notoriously difficult, argumentative. He never married too, famously believed an artist shouldn't have a personal life, that it interfered with the work. He was known for being prickly, for enjoying making people uncomfortable. And he had this very specific, very public hatred of dogs. It was a known thing. If Degas was coming over, you had to hide the family dog. His general personality, this sort of contrariness, it drove people away. Even close friends, like Renoir, apparently distanced themselves from him over time.
So we're left with this picture. The complex, often difficult, prejudiced man on one hand, and the undeniably groundbreaking artist on the other. How do we reconcile that? Where does his artistic legacy stand now?
Well, if we shift the focus purely back to the art itself, to his craft, his position as a major innovator is, frankly, unassailable. He really is a crucial bridge figure between the classical tradition and modern art. And a lot of that comes down to his superb draftsmanship.
Right. The sources mention he really took that advice from Ingres to heart. Draw lines, young man, and still more lines.
Exactly. And that dedication to line, to underlying structure, that's what gives his realism such weight. It really set him apart from many impressionists who were maybe more focused on the fleeting effects of color and light. Degas was always about structure, composition, the kind of bones of the image.
And he kept experimenting, didn't he? Especially with materials later in life, as his eyesight started to fail quite dramatically.
Yeah, that physical challenge actually forced him to adapt, and those adaptations led to some of his most stunning works, ironically. He turned increasingly to pastels. He developed these amazing techniques for layering and blending them, creating incredibly rich, luminous textured effects. Even famous late pieces like the Blue Dancers, you can see him adapting his style, broader strokes, bigger blocks of color, likely to compensate for his failing vision. It's quite moving in a way.
He also embraced technology, photography, in a way that seems to have fundamentally changed how he saw things, how he composed his pictures.
Oh, absolutely. Degas was an early and enthusiastic photographer. He used photographs of nudes, dancers, even friends under artificial light as studies for his paintings and pastels.
Mm.
He actually preferred artificial light called daylight too easy.
Mm.
And that passion for the camera, you see it directly in his work. Those radical crops, the off-center compositions, the asymmetrical viewpoints, it feels so modern. He was essentially taking the aesthetic of photography and also Japanese prints, which he admired, and integrating them into his studio practice. It really revolutionized how artists framed a scene.
So what we're left with is this, well, this staggering contradiction. Degas, the traditionalist, studying the old masters, obsessed with Colline. Yet also Degas, the radical modernist, revolutionizing sculpture, perspective in painting, a brilliant observer of the human body in motion. Yet also a man whose documented racism and anti-Semitism were profound, driving him into a kind of bitter isolation.
Yeah, and his fame just grew and grew in his later years, even as his eyesight failed almost completely, and he was just, you know, wandering the streets of Paris nearly blind. It leaves us, and you, the listener, with a really tough question, doesn't it? When you're looking at a master artist like Degas, someone who brought such unflinching realism, such technical brilliance to art, is it actually possible to fully separate the genius of the work from the, well, the ugliness of the artist's documented beliefs? Is it even necessary to try?